This is Voices in Validation, brought to you by IVT Network. IVT Network is your expert source for life science regulatory knowledge. Voices in Validation brings you the best in validation and compliance topics. We interview industry experts from pharma, biotech, med devices, and laboratories. Here is the host of Voices in Validation, Stacy.
Thank you, and welcome to Risk Revolution, a monthly series of Voices in Validation brought to you by the IVT Network. The goal of this series, as always, is to advance the maturity of risk management practices within the industry by covering topics that challenge quality professionals to seek opportunities to improve and advance the ways in which they perceive and manage risk. This week, we have a full house as our series coordinator, Nuala, is joined once again by regular Risk Revolutionaries co-hosts, Valerie Mulholland and Lori Richter, and we have with us another old friend of the IVT Network, Dr. James Vesper. So welcome to all of you. So great to have you here for what I am sure will be a lively discussion.
Thanks, Stacy. It's always good to be back on our crusade to revolutionize risk. And today we offer a special warm welcome to Jim, who has graciously agreed to join us and share his unique insights and some of his deep learning on a very interesting aspect of risk-based decision-making, that of risk appetite and the distinction between it and risk tolerance. Now, I should declare straight up that I'm a huge fan of Jim's work over the years as a thought leader and as an industry contributor across so many different forums, and particularly, the work that you lead, Jim, in the area of learning and risk management, which is a perfect combination for us nerds on this podcast team. So welcome, Jim. Welcome to you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with y'all.
Yeah. Val and Lori, welcome back to you, ladies. Any words of welcome or other fan confessions from you?
Well, I got to work with Jim, so I was lucky in that respect. But yes, also a big fan. And I reach out to Jim periodically just to chat to as I prepare for my PhD as well. So Jim's been a great help and his articles are always excellent. Thanks, Jim, for coming.
Thank you.
Val.
Hi, Nuala. Hi, Lori. And welcome to Jim. I'm delighted to be here today chatting with him. I don't think anyone is in the industry very long, and certainly not in QRM, before they come across Jim and his writing. And for me, I particularly remember an article in JVT on the 10th anniversary of ICHQ9. I think that was a special bumper edition. And Jim contributed an article about risk communication, which is one of those forgotten boxes, I think, on the ICHQ9 diagram. Mm. And I remember in it, Jim, you said that one of the most important elements in risk assessment and risk management is credibility. That is, you know, that there's trust and transparency. And that's stayed with me ever since, actually. So I have a particular reason for remembering and being grateful to talk to you today, Jim.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I really appreciate that. That's really great.
Good. Okay, so let's get started. Now, Jim, I think at the latest count, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you've contributed 6 books and many, many peer review articles and journal articles. But it's one of your recent contributions that really triggered our collective risk curiosity. And it was entitled, What Are Risk Appetite and Risk Tolerance in Pharma and Medical Devices? And I guess this really opens up our discussion today. And we'll start with where you opened in the article with, you know, reflecting on your own wranglings of late, weighing up everyday risks that we've all faced, in recent times. And you asked yourself in the article, should we host a holiday party for 80 people or how about a smaller event for maybe 30 people who all claim to be fully vaccinated? Or what about we scrap the whole party thing and we just go to a restaurant that requires proof of vaccination? But what about meeting some of those old friends that we haven't seen for 2 years mm-hmm. who we know have not been vaccinated? So we've all been, grappling as citizens throughout the pandemic. We've become risk assessors on behalf of our families in the everyday, practicing risk-based decision every day. So share with us, where you were reflecting there, Jim.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Those were real life questions. You know, every year my husband and I have a holiday party, 80 to 100 people will come in. You know, certainly 2 years ago, we didn't do it. But then here where we live in our region in October, the numbers were really going down. And so we said, yeah, I think we can do this. And then the week in December when Omicron started going up and up and up, you know, really all across New York State where we live, it's like, we don't want to be those people that call our friends and say, hope you had a really nice time at the party, but you're going to have to quarantine for the next 2 weeks, yeah. Especially because, you know, we both have public health degrees and, you know, it would be a little bit embarrassing. So, you know, I think, you know, we've all been dealing with that. And, you know, we have friends that would refuse to go to the grocery store. They would have somebody buy their groceries for them. Others, you know, like me, you know, going to the grocery store with a mask on, you know, doing hand sanitizers, that was sort of the high point of the week because I'm actually getting out of the house. So I think we've all looked at that. And really the underlying issue is, how do we think about that risk? How much appetite do we have for that? How willing are we to put ourselves out there?
Yeah, for sure. And of course, you know, even though we regularly say on this podcast, you know, we make risk-based decisions every day, you know, every mm-hmm. time we leave the house, drive a car across the street. But I guess, you know, we don't necessarily formally classify them. And I think in this period of the pandemic, you know, it has made us much more, you know, in our everyday lives, determining where do we go for the research? What information do we base our decisions on? You know, who do we mm-hmm. trust? As Valerie mentioned, that trustworthiness piece, you know, what sources of information do we trust in terms of making these, you know, what certainly at the early stages of the pandemic, mm-hmm. for many of us, you know, were kind of life and death decisions if we had vulnerable people in our family. Laurie, do you want to jump in there on this whole concept on Jim's thoughts about how we've been reflecting, you know, we've all become kind of personal risk assessors from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just echo Jim's comments too. And I'll add that I'm immune compromised. I'm actually 18 years out from a kidney transplant. So my navigation of this whole thing has almost been to the point of nightmarish. Especially when you're a transplant recipient, you're used to the idea that, you know, anytime you're ill, you usually get sicker. It's for longer. You know, you may need to go to the hospital. There are all those instructions that are always provided for you. So imagine, I used to joke, I don't know why it's a joke for me, but I think it's a way to deal with things. I used to say to my husband, I don't think the transplant's going to be the thing that takes me out. I think it's going to be a microorganism. And then when the pandemic hit, I was like, oh my God, this is like my worst fear, right? So yes, navigating in terms of risk, I'm almost literally exhausted from it. I also have two kids, so there's additional exposure at school. And how do we manage that? Now that things are changing, my risk decision is becoming different. Because unlike most people, I'm not responding as well to the vaccine and things like that. I actually even have 4 doses, right? Not just 3. Mm-hmm. So there's additional now new risk decisions I have to make. What decision do I make with the mask not being required? But maybe for us, it should still be, you know, those kinds of things. So it's hilarious, Jim, that as risk practitioners, you and I, and all of us, I guess, on the call, that we're in this position where we literally are living what we say that, you know, you're doing every day, but it's to another degree now. It's in addition to the normal risk-based decisions you're making, you're now making this one just to figure out whether or not you want to go to a store, right? So yes, I my decisions have definitely, my appetite has had to adjust in terms of risk. I do go out, I do wear my mask. I have been doing a lot more probably than most immune compromised people, but I am making different decisions maybe than immune competent people are making right now.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay, so let's get to some of this definition around risk appetite and risk tolerance. Jim, in your article, you discuss why these two concepts are foundational to how we make risk-based decisions. And yet, you also point out, surprisingly, in a business where, you know, it's all about the risk to the patient, we don't have a definition for these terms in ICHQ9. We don't have a definition even in, you know, what we might consider the more grown-up version of ISO 14971. And the terminology isn't even in our lexicon, you know, in the industry, within our leadership teams. You know, it's not something that you hear people discussing on a routine basis. What do you say about that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And when I started, you know, thinking about it, you know, what did Q9 say? You know, they must say something about that, or, you know, the ISO standards. So they are silent on this. And even the new version, preliminary version of the revised Q9 that we had the chance to look at didn't include those definitions. So for the definitions that I've used, I went to a group called COSO. And it's a group of financial accounting organizations, and they set standards for their members. And there they do define risk appetite and risk tolerance. One other thing that's interesting about COSO is that they define risk a little bit differently, that they also include the benefit of risk. And that makes sense from a financial institution. You know, the more risk that you're willing to accept in an investment, the higher the potential payoff that there is in that. Also, the higher the potential loss that is there. So I went to COSO, and they defined risk appetite as the types and the amount of risk that an organization is prepared to take. And sometimes this can be articulated very strongly. We will do all we can to develop new products to meet the needs of the marketplace, which says, okay, we're going to be out there, and we have a big appetite for risk, and we're prepared to take losses at different times. And then what you would have is a risk tolerance, and risk tolerance is a really more tactical day-to-day type thing. So the example that I often use is in driving. If I'm driving across New York State, and the New York State Thruway speed limit is 65 miles per hour, I will tend to keep up with traffic, and I will drive at 74 miles per hour, and I can drive right past a policeman. I will not get pulled over because that's sort of within the allowance of what's there. Friends of mine, they have a little bit different risk appetite, where mine is, you know, I don't want to get a speeding ticket. I don't want to get my insurance points, you know, raised. That's a possibility, but I'm not that worried about it. So they will drive, you know, 81, 84 miles per hour. So their appetite is shifted. So that's appetite. What risk tolerance would be is how far over that limit that I've internally set for myself am I willing to go in certain situations? So if I'm passing a truck, maybe I will go 84, 85 miles per hour, but then drop back to a much lower speed as I'm continuing on the trip. But that risk tolerance, it has a little bit more flexibility over time.
Yeah, and I guess, what we're saying there then is, you know, the appetite is that, kind of general, like you say, the types and amount of risk an organization might be prepared to take. They might be prepared to take more risk on a new, you know, innovative product. But like you say, when it comes to safety in their organization, yes, with their employees, or exposure to API or something, they may be much more conservative in that area, and they may define a much more conservative of risk appetite to do with safety associated risks. And that then, you know, introducing that concept of tolerance, that you've got these levels and that they may shift depending on your control strategy that you might be employing. Like you say, if you're overtaking the truck, but you're going to drop back down to a more acceptable level within moments. Yeah, so really interesting. Val, how did these definitions and distinctions align with the work that you've been doing around risk-based decision-making, these kind of threshold concepts, as we've discussed in several previous episodes and of course, more recently in our picking over the bones of ICH Q9 R1 and with your recent research focus group that you ran. Wait, how do you feel about these concepts?
Well, first, I'm a bit of a stickler for definitions, and Jim and Laurie and I have had these discussions in recent weeks while reviewing ICH Q9 R1. because I believe in avoiding ambiguity, and ambiguities arise when people take different meanings from things, and it's important to be clear, I think. So I think it's great when someone puts it out there that we need more clarity on something, in this case, the definition of risk appetite and risk tolerance. And these are two important decision criteria when it comes to risk-based decision making. So it's kind of surprising there's no definitions out there and no definitions close to home, that we have to look to the financial sector for something that applies. Because I think, Jim, there is a definition, and you probably know this, of risk tolerance in the ISO Guide 51, but it's not as relatable as the ones that Jim is putting forward, you know. And oddly, the ISO standard also deems risk tolerance to be a synonymous term with risk appetite. So there's an ambiguity straight away, if you like, you know. But the ISO guide does state that the level of risk that's accepted in a given context based on the current values of society. And I think the attractive little element in that definition, probably the only attractive little element, is that it does point out that stakeholders can have different views on risk tolerance and risk appetite, and that those views can change over time. And I was reminded of that, just to bring the COVID thing back in again, you know, those early conversations during the COVID pandemic on the lateral flow testing kits, or the antigen kits, as we variously call them. And there were a lot of early discussions related to reliability, and there was a mixed appetite for using those type of test kits because of the possibility of false negatives versus PCRs. But as we developed an understanding of their limitations and the appropriate use, you know, and the benefits of using them as an additional layer of protection were understood, then the appetite and tolerance for using them changed, and different decisions and recommendations were made on that basis, you know. So risk appetite, or how many zeros of risk reduction we need to chase down or reduce, or risk tolerance, how tight we want our controls around a certain risk to be, they're important management decisions, and they should be framing the risk-based decision-making within QRM and within the wider organisation. And I think that's the point, Jim, you were trying to raise there, and I'd echo it very strongly, really, to be honest.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Laurie, did you want to jump in on anything there?
Yeah, I was actually just going to add that the interesting part about the risk appetite and risk tolerance definitions that Val and Jim have both pointed out actually caused us confusion as well, because at like about a month ago or so, the team I've been leading, which is a risk culture team for the last 18 months, and that risk culture team is driven to encourage conversations about risk, encourage understanding what the risk mitigation options are, what the benefit is maybe to taking that risk. We actually started to come to a place where we started talking about risk appetite and risk tolerance. Now, what we realized is we were using those interchangeably, because that's how they kind of are defined in some of the guidance documents that Value pointed out. However, we also went and looked at the financial sector, and we saw those two distinctions, Jim. So it was just funny to really interesting to see your article. It was so timely based on where my team has kind of matured to and where they're at. But it's interesting also to me, I'll just close out by saying that those things were not clearly defined in ICHQ9, when the power behind risk management is really the decisions that you're trying to make. So I found that kind of interesting that came up a lot in the discussion.
Yeah, yeah. So let's just bring these concepts a little bit further. Jim, in your article, you also talk about how, you know, the FDA, of course, requires drugs to be safe and effective, which falls in under the risk appetite that they have definition. And this is, of course, demonstrated typically through, you know, extensive clinical testing or evaluated as the agency, you know, makes those decisions around drug approvals or licensing, which might fall in under the definition of risk tolerances and where they set those levels. However, of course, all that went out the window when we had, you know, during the COVID situation with the emergency use authorizations, that they had to be much more nimble and much more flexible around those thresholds. And that enabled, you know, a speed of a focus of attention and a speed of action that, you know, wasn't traditionally there within the the traditional timeframes. You know, talk to me a little bit about where you were going there.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. You know, safe and effective drugs, safe, pure and effective drugs. That's what we all want. That's what health authorities around the world are wanting in the drugs that their populations are using. But then, you know, how much data do you need to support that safe, pure and effective level? And I think what they looked at is what is the risk benefit ratio? You know, do we keep drugs from being approved and there are people dying that could benefit from a vaccine in particular of that until we have all this data? Or do we say, okay, let's go with what we have, put it out there, have some really significant monitoring tools that's, you know, that are watching this, that are looking at this in real time, so we can respond, you know, if there is a spike in problems. And we saw that a couple times, you know, there was one vaccine that there were some cardiac incidents related to that. Well, they stopped that for almost immediately, did some investigation, found that it was still within reasonable limits for that, and then allocated or opened up that vaccine for use as well. So I think, you know, it's that combination of things where you have to say, okay, what is the benefit here that we're going to do? You know, there are certain things, you know, microbiology, you know, it still has to be pure. We still don't want products that have black specks in them. But, you know, there are other things here that we can be a little bit more flexible on and still be able to make sure that the benefit of that product, that vaccine, is being seen by the population.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that this why I like the concepts that you've introduced and why I think they're, you know, they're a really valuable contribution to the leadership view around risk-based decision making is by establishing that risk appetite and establishing that threshold, you can then determine in given situations that you're going to shift that. You're going to, like you say, take on more risk, or you're going to put in more monitoring, or you know, you're going to put additional oversight in place in order to confirm that your assumptions were hold true. But without those kind of goalposts where you've defined the area of interest and the sphere of influence that you're trying to look at, what we see, or certainly what I see in the field, is a lot of ad hocery, ad hoc decision making, you know, which you know, they hit upon as a result of an issue arising, and we've got reactive risk management happening. Whereas I, you know, we're great proponents on this podcast about proactive risk management, and I feel that this risk appetite, risk tolerance concept can enable us to be much more proactive about, we're in this space, the reason we're here, and here's the controls we put around that. Laurie or Val, like, what about yourself in the field in terms of, you know, what are you seeing, any awareness of this risk appetite or risk tolerance?
Well, I think what you see a little bit more common is a lack of awareness of risk appetite and tolerance. You know, for example, you can sit in and listen and hear, you know, a risk scoring exercise, and, you know, people are slugging it out whether something scores a low or a medium or a high. And, you know, there's clearly a range of risk appetites in the discussion and different attitudes to what should be accepted or tolerated in terms of risk. And I think if we put more structure on the governance of that, as you said, the goalposts, the guardrails, this is the attitude or appetite of the company, it might help those discussions. I mean, I know we all have quality policies in our company and we state that quality and safety are very key objectives, but they don't give a great steer when you're down in the weeds trying to determine a sampling plan for a material or how confident you need to be in your environmental monitoring regime, you know. And another thing is, I don't hear much conversation around risk tolerance when scoring detection. You know, yes, I have an automated detection system, so I'm giving it a very luscious green on the matrix, but the performance of that detector, you know, we mentioned false negatives there with kids earlier, you know. You know, what is the performance of that machine, and are you willing to tolerate any variability that it may be presenting to your risk control plan? So I think there are very, you know, fundamental risk decisions made within QRM that could benefit from a better steer as you said, at the management level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jim.
Yeah, I think what Valerie said, she two really important points. She was talking about proactive and also governance. And if you look at the emergency use authorization that FDA had, they didn't do it at the spur of the moment, in the heat of, what are we going to do now? But they already had that guidance put in place because they had thought, what if this sort of situation occurs? So, you know, they had a structure there that they just weren't reacting to, but they could do this in a really thoughtful way. And I think that is really important, you know, for getting people to talk about these things before you're in the heat of passion, before the fire is blazing.
Yeah, for sure. Laurie, and any thoughts about getting this dialogue opened up with the leadership teams?
Yeah, actually, I was just going to add to, I think risk appetite and risk tolerance is probably talked about at the board of directors level. I think that's kind of understood sometimes at that higher level. I think where we don't see it is everywhere else in the organization that could nicely feed up to that level. So one of the things that I'm excited about that I think Nuala is kind of alluding to is I'm actually going to do an exercise like that with a cross-functional leadership team to really establish what are those categories of appetite that risk appetite, what are we even looking at? And one of the things that I think got brought up earlier today is, you know, maybe regulatory requirements. Maybe that's a non-negotiable. We don't want to, you know, sort of mess with that. So that's going to be a low, you know, risk type of item. Our appetite is going to be very low there. We're not going to push the boundaries, right? But maybe innovative technologies, maybe that's a place where we're willing to take a bit more risk because the benefit might be really great for the patient, right? Always thinking back about the patient when we're establishing that appetite and tolerance. So that's something I think that I don't see us have those frank conversations. And in fact, I often wonder sometimes if in leadership teams, they walk away sort of wondering why each other came to these conclusions because they didn't know how to have that appetite discussion and go, here's the things I was considering when I looked through that risk. Here's my tolerance for those different areas as the leader of XYZ, whatever that group is. Maybe you're the chief quality officer or the CEO or what your appetites and tolerances are going to be different because of the role that you play in the organization. And I don't know if we have those kind of structured conversations because we haven't even defined that yet, right? At those levels, we haven't had the conversations of what is risk appetite, what is risk tolerance, and then where am I in that spectrum of things? So I'm excited to kind of get those conversations going. I have an opportunity to do that, and I'd like to see how that's going to unfold. And I'm also interested in them having honest conversations with each other because of the levels they're at. I think that discomfort is going to be where we bloom, right, with our decision making and our clarity to our communications of why we made the decisions that we did.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, Jim, you offer an opener for six, you know, potentially for Laurie, you can, yeah, I'm sure you can lean into this, but for leadership teams to be able to have that conversation, you offer a spectrum of risk appetite and a set of four factors. I'm not saying that they would need to be the same for each organization, but it might be a starting point where they might be able to say, well, you know, where are we on this spectrum and what, you know, what would those mm-hmm. definitions could you share those factors and that sure. spectrum that you present with our listeners?
Sure. Yeah, this was a spectrum. It was developed by a person by the name of Quayle in 2017. I became acquainted to it by another colleague of Laurie and mine, Amanda McFarland, who showed it to me. And it looks at things, I'm just looking at my notes here, of risk philosophy, tolerance for uncertainty, of choice, and also the trade-offs. What are the trade-offs that are there? To me, one of the really interesting illuminators about risk appetite and risk tolerance is with uncertainty. And one of the ways that I've seen that play out is if you do not know the likelihood of occurrence of something, and you're using a 5-point scale, you're doing like an FMEA, you're using a 5-point scale, where do you risk, I don't know, where do you rate, I don't know? You know, some firms will, that are really risk adverse, they will put it as the highest level there. Other firms say, well, it could be high, it could be low, we'll put it in the middle. So to me, that's sort of a telling point about how they view of risk in that case, but uncertainty. So you have these different areas that you are concerned with, but then you have, you know, what is the range there that you have? You could have somebody that's, you know, really willing, they're open to that risk, and other people that are just totally shut off from that. That example I used about going to the grocery store during COVID. Some people say, no way, I'm going to have my food brought in, where others are saying, yeah, let's go to the grocery store. Well, wear a mask, I'll wear this level of protection that I deem to be appropriate, and I will expose myself to that level of hazard, of that potential source of harm, but I feel that I'm protected in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really good. So even just, of course, in our goodie bag takeaway, we'll share the article. But I think even, to put that on a slide and start to have that conversation and, mm-hmm. and define some of that. Val or Lori, what do you think about, do you think their leadership teams will be willing to start to have this conversation and to use this as a framework?
I think so. I think one of the things I'm trying to determine now is the strength of facilitation that is needed for that conversation. So I think that's the thing I'm kind of trying to develop in my mind. But I think if the conversation is guided with some kind of framework, I think mm-hmm. these conversations can happen. And am I suggesting that someone hold up their heat map every time they're making a decision and go, all right, on the sliding scale of innovation, I'm here, and on regulatory health authorities, I'm here? No, not necessarily. But I think the team establishing that and having that in the background of always when they're making their decisions, like, okay, maybe they're up against a new molecule. And they're like, all right, based on what we know right now and what kind of risk we're taking at this company and what we know to be true about where this molecule is at is in its development, financial, all of those categories, is this a risk worth taking, right? And moving those kind of, I almost envision like an abacus and the categories are over here and I'm moving the beads back and forth, if you will. I think that's worth having. I think we don't have the structure right now. And I think sometimes the decisions may bring in new information or new types of categories that other decisions weren't factoring in because there's not some sort of structure or standardized approach to it. So I think it is a good decision and I think it's willing to happen. I think they just don't even know they're not having the discussion, if you will, because mm-hmm. it's not clearly defined, right, to have that. And I'm going to lastly go on record as I'm still getting my groceries put into my car by the people at the grocery store because now I just love it. So, it keeps getting brought up. So I'm just going to own it. sorry, Val, I don't know if you have other thoughts.
Oh, that. I was just listening to what you were saying there. And it struck me that those conversations might also go a way to break down some of the reputations in this area. I think there are definitely, you hear in the language within organizations, the quality department have a reputation for being risk averse, and the engineering department are perceived by the quality department to have the opposite risk appetite. And you can kind of hear this and that those arguments, and very often the word that's bandied around. And I remember having a conference once on QRM, and this came up a lot, where they were saying, the quality don't trust us to make the right decisions, so there was that word trust coming into it again. Whereas I think as you're proposing, Jim and Lori, as you're kind of creating the visual of what that conversation might look like, it might help if, everybody understood where the boundaries are and why, and how acceptable it is to maybe step over boundaries as a trade-off to something else. And, I think they might be create a mutual understanding in an organization also, which could be very helpful.
Yeah, for sure.
I love that, Val. I love, though, that mm-hmm. they're actually having the chance to have those, because you might be surprised. You might find out those engineering folks that you thought were so wild and crazy, maybe they were really concerned about the regulatory filing approach, or, mm-hmm. They had really considered that in there, because you're breaking those walls down. I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I love it too. Coming back to what we do have to live with in our sector, looking at the Q9 diagram that Val mentioned at the top, you point out Jim in your article, you know, several places along the Q9 formal risk management process that risk appetite and risk tolerance can influence those risk-based decisions that are being taken along. Can you share some of your thoughts on how we can integrate them into the overall management process?
Sure. You know, one of the things is you begin that risk activity, and you know, oftentimes this will be in a policy or in a procedure. You're setting forth, okay, what are the rating scales that we're going to use? You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, we're not generally using the high, medium, low words descriptors now, but we're putting in keywords. What does this really look like? So for example, if you are dealing with the compliance domain related to risk, you know, where do you place getting a 483 or a major observation from a health authority versus a critical observation? You know, here, if you're regulated by US FDA, you know, you have a 483, you have the potential of a warning letter. We were in a situation with major pharma company when we were trying to set these levels. And it's like, where do you put the 483? Mm-hmm. Out of a 5-point scale, do you put it at 4? Or do you put it at maybe 3 or even 2? You know, 483s happen. It's not the end of the world. So where do you place that in that scheme? So I think talking about that, what does this mean to us as an organization? And I think one of the things that really relates to as well is risk evaluation. When we're evaluating, you know, we have all these scores here, we see where we are. How are we going to say, okay, these are the risks that we have to do something about, that red zone, and you're thinking about a heat map or in a matrix versus the yellow that we should do something. You know, those are those risks that if it's possible to reduce them farther, let's do it if there's value in that, versus the green, which is the risks that we are accepting as is. So that's another place where you see that this can be thought through in your risk evaluation stage. And we know, where are we going to put that? And I think doing those things up front, you know, setting those scales, setting those definitions, setting that risk matrix for decision making up front gives you a lot better objective way of making those decisions. And it's not just the risk score is going to be too high for this one, so if we reduce that from 4 to 2, it's going to be better. You know, that's not a fair, we all have heard that, but that's really not a fair way of doing that that risk assessment.
Yeah. And, you know, I also see a real need for the other neglected box at the back end of the diagram, risk review, you know, being able to have these discussions when we look back and we reflect on, well, let's look at all those prospective risk decisions we took. How, you know, did we hit the target? Yeah. How good did we do? And does that change our, you know, as a result of the ding we had, you know, the failures that we took, the hits that we took? Has that changed our appetite or our tolerance levels anywhere? Is there any need for us to go back and reflect on those? And I think that this, again, would be a great framework of framing those risk reviews so that you're having those conversations around the prioritized risk. So often in risk reviews, I see, you know, there's 100 risks on the risk register and we have to start at number one and talk till we get to 100 and everybody's dead. Instead, you know, I'd much prefer we were taking the time of that risk review to talk about the top 5 risks and you know, assume that the mechanics of our processes are capable of managing the other 95, you know, that they're working their way through the system and they're getting appropriate attention. But very often we don't see the wood from the trees because we're dealing with the long list all the time. We don't get to the short list, you know? Yeah, and I think that this could be a great way to do that. You know, another thing that you mentioned is both these internal and external factors that can have an impact on risk-based decisions. You know, things like, you know, can we get a resupply in time? Is there a way the material can legitimately be approved for use if we're looking at our mm-hmm. supply disruption? You know, and some of those implications for rejection. And I think you talked about, you know, in some cases, you know, traditionally you might have had a very risk averse if it wasn't absolutely within specification, the batch was rejected. And maybe those discussions are being had now in terms of putting mm-hmm. additional oversight or other things in play. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. Concept. Yeah, that really goes to another concept called risk capacity. How much risk are you able to take on? And, you know, your mention about rejecting a batch. You know, I've been in the pharma industry for at least 30 years, and I used to work for Eli Lilly. And if we had a problem with a batch of insulin, okay, throw it out a couple million dollars of value, but we have another set of insulin crystals, you know, ready to go, no problem. But now when we talk about some of the supply chains and having our bulk material being made another part of the world, how can we get it quickly to us? We don't have the storage and the warehousing, and things are more just in time. Not as great as in some industries, but you know, certainly there is that there. When it comes to compliance issues, if you have had a stellar record with the health authority that is your regulator, you may be a little bit more willing to go out on that edge, that risk tolerance, to be not to violate anything, but a little bit different versus if you have had a couple of warning letters. And you have a huge amount of scrutiny, and you don't want to rock the boat at all. So, you know, what's that capacity that you have there? And I think that's a really important thing. You know, how much money are you willing to lose? You know, thinking about investments. You know, there's some investments that you make that are for sophisticated investors that you have to have a minimum amount of money because you say, investing in that Broadway show, you're probably going to lose everything. But you know, it might be worth it to you.
It might be a hit. Val, what about what about your thoughts on this risk capacity concept?
Yeah, and I think Jim's conversation there about supply chain is very interesting. You know, the case that struck me as he was talking was the case of the nitrosamines. You know, yeah. The risk appetite for that impurity was, well, in a way it was set in the pharmacopoeia, you know, within the total unknown impurity criteria. But when it became more known and there was greater awareness about its frequency of occurrence, then, you know, options and appetites had to be revisited. And, you know, most of the medication affected by that issue were long-term medications. So there was that huge concern on the harm side. But those medications were also needed and they were giving benefits to patients. And that was a concern on the supply side. And recalls and rejections, you know, had the impact had the potential to impact the supply of those essential and beneficial medications. And it was a real example of new knowledge, creating a new risk review, to come back to your point on review, Nuala, and a reevaluation of the risk appetite and tolerance for that risk, you know, within the overall criteria and guardrails of keeping that medicine safe. It was a very interesting exercise throughout which clear communication was needed to assure and reassure all those patients on those medications that they could continue to take them and clinicians could continue to prescribe them, you know. So to come back to my fan squeal at the start for Jim, you know, credibility and trust, again, were really important there. And, you know, and to twist the story as well, you know, that establishing criteria for your risk appetite or your risk tolerance, it also helps you to demonstrate that you're not willing to cross a boundary, you know. You know, even when something new or conflicting comes along, that you have a process for evaluating it and you know where those appetite and boundaries are and you're not willing to cross them without due justification and evidence and proof. So it's a kind of a double-edged argument also.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. Laurie, in closing, we're nearly at the, we could be here all evening, but we're nearly at the time. Do you have anything to add on that before we wrap?
No, I was actually just going to continue to add to the conversation around risk review. We started to get into that. And I'm just going to second the comments around, if you do develop this understanding of your risk appetite, and all of the things I think that Jim, you're mentioning in your article, that you also remember to revisit that, because based on where the company is at, based on where the industry is at, based on where your pipeline is at, that appetite's likely going to change. And one example that came to me was when a lot of us faced drug shortages a few years ago. That was quite a bit of, you know, talk in the industry, and there was a lot of issues around that. And I think that philosophy, Jim, of, you know, if there's just one hiccup in that lot, we'll discard it, right? That was a philosophy I came from as well. I was from a large scale manufacturing facility many years ago. It was safer, it was cleaner, it was quicker, you know, to do that.
Yep.
When drug shortages came, that philosophy changed, right? Then it was, okay, now we need to really evaluate and understand what happened here and whether or not this batch is salvageable, because we have patients at the end of the day that are on a long-term care for this drug, and it may be a greater risk for us to discard it and them to go without their treatment. So suddenly that risk decision changed, right? And that appetite sort of shifted in terms of some of those decisions. It doesn't mean we were releasing things that were going to put patients at risk. It meant that if we didn't release it and made those quick decisions to just discard, we may actually put the patient more at risk because they may lose their treatment. So I think those are things to consider with that risk appetite. And I love that we brought it to risk review, because it's always that languishing, you know, last box that sort of gets left out, you know? So yes, I think those external factors and considering those in your appetite are very important over time.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts, anyone, before we wrap? No? Great. So,
go ahead. You're Jim. Absolutely right. We could be talking about this all evening, because I think it's a really fascinating conversation. And people think about this in their own organizations, you know, just to start talking about it, you know, not in a real formal, this is the decision, but you know, what is our appetite here? I think to do that in a real casual, more informal way can really get people to be comfortable with these concepts and then see how they can be applied.
Yeah. As I like to always say, be risk curious, right, Jim? Just at least talk about it, right? That's all curiosity means, right? We don't even have to put any other definition around it. At least talk about it.
Right.
For sure. So Stacey, back to you.
Thanks so much. What a great discussion. Get people thinking, certainly about what their tolerance is within their own organization. And it always is helpful to have many different perspectives. So I love the idea, Lori, of just being curious and having the conversation. So with that, Nuala, remind us what some of the key takeaways are from today's Risk Revolution episode that our listeners can look for in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. As always, we like to give our listeners a goodie bag. So of course, Jim's latest article will be there. But in deference to what Val mentioned earlier on, that risk communication article that Jim wrote for our ICHQ9 10th anniversary edition. And while we're bringing up that excellent risk communication, we might as well dust off the other ones from the shelf and give the whole bumper edition as a gift. There's some brilliant articles that I still go back to them to this day, you know, in terms, and a lot of talk about uncertainty and the problems of scoring. So some great takeaways there for our listeners, Stacey.
Excellent. Thank you so much to all of our risk revolutionaries, Nuala, Val, Lori, great to have you back. And of course, our guest today, Jim. I also want to give a big shout out to our producer, Ben Kitchen. And lastly, a big thank you to you, our valued listeners. We appreciate your time and support in sharing this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review in your podcast streaming service. And don't forget to tag Voices in Validation as you share with your friends, colleagues, and online networks. For today's show notes and information on the takeaways, please visit www.ivtnetwork.com/podcast. And we'll be back again next week with another great interview. Until then, stay healthy and safe.